Mein heutiger Gast ist eine absolute Koryphäe im Pre-Sales. Er hat 15 Jahre bei Salesforce gearbeitet. Er hat miterlebt, wie dieser Konzern von 2500 Mitarbeitenden auf über 70.000 gewachsen ist. Und er hat dabei, und jetzt halte ich fest, es mit seinem Team geschafft, 6.000 Sales Engineers mit einer Plattform auszustatten, die jährlich über 438.000 Live-Demos ermöglicht. Er hat dabei automatisierte Tools entwickelt, die über 480.000 Arbeitsstunden gespart und somit 42 Millionen Dollar eingespart haben. Also wirklich Wahnsinnszahlen, Wahnsinnsdimensionen. Dieser Mensch hat alles gesehen, wenn es darum geht, wie man Pre-Sales-Teams und Prozesse skaliert. Nun, solche Koryphäen findet man nicht alle Tage, deswegen bin ich besonders stolz, dass wir ihn für ein Gespräch gewinnen konnten. Er ist aber Amerikaner, wobei er inzwischen in München wohnt. Ich habe tatsächlich mich mit ihm persönlich getroffen in einem Podcast-Studio. Wenn du Lust hast, schau mal bei YouTube vorbei, da siehst du uns in dem Studio sitzen. Also der Mensch ist, wie gesagt, Amerikaner, spricht deswegen natürlich Englisch. In diesem Moment haben wir die Ausnahme gemacht und ich glaube, es ist es wert. Wir haben auch ziemlich lange gesprochen, knapp anderthalb Stunden geht der Podcast. So, wenn jetzt du dich fragst, wann ist eigentlich der richtige Zeitpunkt, so ein Pre-Sales-Support-Team aufzubauen, um noch mehr zu skalieren? Welche KPIs können dabei helfen? Und was hat das Ganze auch mit James Bond und der Q-Branch zu tun? Ja, dann könnte diese Folge was für dich sein. Voller Inspiration, konkrete Ansätze mit unserem Gast Micah Joel. So I took the liberty this morning and checked out your LinkedIn profile once again, even though I already looked at it a couple of weeks back. And then I saw you've been working. So your last stint was at Salesforce.
That's correct.
And you were there for, correct me, 15 years?
15 years.
And that's a long time to work in tech, right? I mean, if I look at my grandfather, yes, he has worked the same job for like 30 years. And that's in that generation, it's normal. In our generation, I feel like especially working in tech, switching employers, maybe even after like 5-6 years, even in Germany, that's normal, even though we are more conservative when it comes to that. Yeah. There are some people, especially when you go into like go-to-market functions, maybe 2 or 3 years is quite common. You've been there for 15 years. What kept you so long?
Well, I would say this. At a company that's growing that fast, every year is different. So it feels like a new company every few years. When I joined, there were 2,500 people. And so everybody knew everybody. We were all in the same building pretty much. And then, you know, within 2 or 3 years, they had a new headquarters and there was new work being done and the products were different and the markets were different. So it was an interesting job for the number of years I worked there. Also, I changed venues. So I was in San Francisco for 3 years and then I moved to Sydney, Australia and spent 4 years there. So change of scene, new people, you know, new markets. And then something related to something I'm sure I'll talk about later, but something we found is when we did satisfaction surveys of solution engineers over the years, we found that and we did it about the demo. We said, what do you think of the demo? What's your level of satisfaction? Mm-hmm. We found that there was a dip at 3 years. New people loved it. At about 3 years, people didn't like it. At 5 and 6 years, people did like the demo. And 7 years of tenure or so, they started to get itchy again and not like the demo. And we took that to mean that they were, you know, that it wasn't us, but it was something about the cycle of, you know, 3-year itch, 7-year itch. And at 7 years, I got itchy and I stopped being a solution engineer. And this is when I went into the whole demo field. So I basically changed jobs at 7 years, even though it was within the same company, and moved to London. So I had a new place again.
Yes.
So it was, I think, at least for me, even though 15 years is a long time, it was an ever-changing job at an ever-changing company. So it made it a little bit easier.
I mean, the time when Salesforce had 2,500 employees, that's a very different animal to what it is today.
It was. It was fun. It's still fun. Look, I can't say anything bad about the company. I really enjoyed my time there. It's a good company with a good heart, but it's a very different character when it's a small company than when it's a large company. And to see it go through those phases, you become the old man of the mountain. Oh, when I started, we had to, you know, push rocks up hills both ways, right? When I didn't have people to help me do my demos, there was no solution, you know, support organization. So it was definitely a different time. But I think you develop closer camaraderies at a smaller company. There were 10 of us on my team and we all worked elbow to elbow out of San Francisco. Later on, your team's distributed. By the end of my tenure there, I had 20 people on my team and I had met 3 of them. And the other 17, either through COVID or other reasons, I hadn't actually met in person before. They were all in different countries.
Okay.
So the camaraderie, I think, is much closer when you're physically close with people, but also when the company's smaller.
100%. And now you already dropped some of the bits we're going to go in deeper today, right? So you said, hey, solution engineer support team. And in fact, if you were to go on your LinkedIn profile, which once again, I did this morning again, it says your last title was senior director Q branch.
Now, we may have a couple of German listeners in here. So Q-branch is maybe not a word that everyone knows, but I'm sure everyone knows James Bond.
Yes.
So maybe you can take us there. What's the story with the name?
I'm so glad you asked. So in every James Bond film, there's this scene, usually near the beginning, where James Bond meets this guy in like a tweed jacket. And that guy gives James Bond all the tools that he uses. He gives him the exploding pen and the watch with the laser beam and the car with the missiles. And that guy's name is Q. That's his role. He's Q. And everyone has code names in MI6. So he's Q. But the people behind him, usually in those scenes, there's a couple guys behind him in lab coats. And they're usually like blowing up a mannequin or something. and they're sort of like, they're kind of like cool nerds, right? They're doing this really interesting, edgy stuff. They're using all the latest technology. And that organization that Q runs is called Q Branch. And so we took that name for our organization. The organization existed already. It was called Sales Support Engineering. Very sexy name. And so we decided to give it something a little more encouraging.
A more shiny surface.
A much shinier surface. And it did a couple of things. It was actually really fun because it gave us some branding language. So for the first couple of years of Q Branch, we got to do some, you know, I always had like an Aston Martin in my slides because James Bond drives an Aston Martin, or we'd have sort of spy theme stuff. And but what it also did is it gave us the ability to recruit people into the organization, because we went from just being an organization to being a cool organization, having a cool name, right? You wanted to be there. You wanted to be. Q Branch is where like the smart people went, right? The cool nerds.
Yes.
So it made it a lot easier when you said, hey, you want to come work for Q Branch? And they go, oh yeah, I've heard all about you. That just helped us attract a lot of talent.
It's so funny how such a minor detail can make such a huge difference. But I really appreciate the analogy. And now to continue the analogy, who's James Bond in that scenario?
Oh, the SE for sure, right? And I think that's one of the reasons it worked, because SEs, you know, they're at the pointy end of the sales cycle. They're out in front of the customers. They're the agents out in the field. I mean, even the terminology in sales is the same as with spycraft. So the SEs are out there. They're exposed. They're dealing with competitors. They're dealing with customers. And so it made it really nice to think of ourselves as equipping them for their mission. Okay, here, you know, your mission, if you're going to go out and sell this customer, here's the tools you need to do that. And it also helped with their self-image too, because we keep referring to them not quite as agents, but the implication was there. And the implication that we had their back was really important as well. We were the team behind the scenes making them successful.
You are the protagonist. You are the superstar. And
that's
we
right.
help you out.
We're just like a supporting character. We're the comedic.
But now, that already triggers my first question. So obviously, solution engineers, sales engineers were at the center of the services that you provided. And we can go a bit deeper in what that entailed in detail. But were account executives, customer success, they were not part of the picture, not part of your internal customer group, so to say?
They weren't explicitly part of the internal customer group. But one of the things I learned over the years is demos touches absolutely everything. So there were AEs, account executives, who were doing demos, especially down in the small to medium-sized business area, because solution engineering resources are scarce. So they had to do their own demos. So they were using the tools we provided. And in fact, later on, we started targeting tools at account executives as well, simpler demos that they could deliver easily. Customer service also, when new products came out, we were usually the first team to get them implemented somewhere. So customer service would take a demo environment and would use that to show customers what was coming down the pipe. So we had some incidental audiences, and we always had conversations internally within our team about, you know, should we expand our scope? Will we get more funding? Will we get more attention if we say we're supporting everything? But most of the time, because we were allied in the organization that was the solution engineering organization and they were funding us, it was best for us to position the work we were doing as SE focused.
Now, I would like to start at the journey. Maybe we can take also the Salesforce example, because that's where I've been for it. Has Q Branch existed, or whatever it was called at the time, when the company was 2,500 employees large, or was that something that was incepted during your stint there?
Yeah, I wish I could take credit for it, but a gentleman named Todd Janzen, sort of the father of demos and demo automation at Salesforce, he started the SSE organization, the solution support organization, solution support engineers. And what it started as really was just a team of talented college grads. It was a recruitment program. You'd bring in these young ex-students to do the scut work that the SEs didn't want to do. So there was a lot of work on demos that took time, and you could put in a request to this team, and one of these talented, relatively young employees would take this request and would do what needed doing, branding or loading data or changing something. And so it was a labor focus. And from that grew a part of the team that started focusing on demo environments themselves, because SEs were kind of maintaining their own demo environments at the time. Mm-hmm. And so he started to have a couple of people kind of half-timing. There was only one demo environment at the time. So we'll keep an eye on this demo environment and make it better. So the organization existed, but like I said, it didn't have a particularly sexy name, but it was already well-liked by the SEs. Anyone, you know, when I was a solution engineer, I would definitely put in an SE assist and someone would help me with things. Right. In particular, things I wasn't technical enough to do. Most of these folks were coming out of technical programs or computer science programs. And so if I wanted to come up with something really flashy in my demo, but I just didn't have the ability to do it, I could engage one of them and, you know, we'd go back and forth and they'd show me this cool, shiny thing I could show the customers. An example, for example, of something we can do on our platform.
What I would like to understand, what triggered the inception of the department? So you say, okay, even at 2,500 employee, there was already the first instance of that function available. Looking back at my own history of SaaS employers, we didn't always have that. There were a couple of examples where we did have it, and we can maybe talk about those as well. I would like to understand what are the symptoms, so to say, to look out for that tells me, hey, maybe now is the time to incept such a solution engineer support team. And I would like to put it in context. We are mainly talking, obviously, to German companies. We have mainly German listeners also on this conversation. If you go to any type of events, like events where SaaS people come together, where go-to-market comes together, Germany, or maybe even like venture capital funding and startups and scale-ups and so on, and you go around and you ask anyone, hey, what's pre-sales? They quite often think we are talking about cold acquisition, we're talking about cold calling, we're talking about cold emailing. So the front line of the funnel, so to say. So what I'm trying to get at, in our country, in this ecosystem in Germany, the sales engineering and pre-sales function itself is not even that, let's say, popular yet. I think in some companies have realized they need it. To give one concrete example, there's a startup, or not startup anymore, they are unicorn by now, but they were funded here in Munich, founded and funded in Munich, Personio. Right. But for the longest time, they didn't have the function. Now they are big enough and they realized, okay, we need it. Now they have a team of 10 servicing Europe. But this is quite contrary to most SaaS companies that come from the US, where it's basically a given. We need pre-sales. Now you tell me, okay, there's even an idea to go even one step further. Not only do we need pre-sales, but we need a pre-sales support function. And I would like to distill it out. What are the indicators that tell me we need a pre-sales support function, even on top of our pre-sales team?
Yeah, I'd say there's a couple of things. Probably the first thing is when you notice that SEs are a scarce resource, when sales management or when salespeople are fighting over SEs and where there's not enough SEs to go around. That, I think that's a really common problem. I think probably every company has that problem. Because I think there's literally there's no way to have enough SEs. If you matched an SE one for one with every salesperson, then the salespeople will shrug off more of their work onto the SE, right? So there's no way to have enough SEs in an organization. And SEs are expensive. So you don't want to have more SEs than you have salespeople in most cases. So I think that's one thing. One thing you'll notice is your SEs are scarce and you're starting to feel the effect on your business that meetings are being delayed because an SE resource isn't available. AEs are demoing themselves because they can't get an SE. And sometimes those demos are of a widely varying quality, I'll say, charitably.
Über 1000 Menschen im Vertrieb und Presales von Unternehmen wie SAP, Salesforce oder LeanIX profitieren bereits heute vom Discodeck. Mit den 60 wichtigsten Fragen rund um Entscheidungsfindung, wirtschaftliche Faktoren, Technologie und 5 weiteren Kategorien bringt es deine Discovery auf die nächste Stufe. Das Discodeck ist in deutscher und englischer Sprache verfügbar. Klick dich jetzt rein und sichere dir dein Exemplar unter discodeck.shop. Direkter Link findest du auch in den Shownotes. Vielen Dank für deinen Support und jetzt zurück zur Folge.
So thing one is just seeing the resource constraint and realizing that you have a problem with the number of SEs compared to the number of deals that you have. I'd say a second indicator is the language that people use. When an organization says things like, oh, our SEs are heroes, they do everything, they're so important to us, that tells me right away that their SEs are over. Their SEs are doing kind of everything. They're everywhere at all times. There are a lot of competing priorities. And so those SEs are stretched very thin. And that tells me there's a possibility of burnout, possibility of unhappiness of the SEs that they feel, especially when you're pairing an SE with an AE, where the AE gets all the glory when the deal closes and everyone, they pat the SE on the head. They get a share sometimes of the commission, but never the kind of share that the AE gets. Yeah. So you can see the impact on the business and you can also hear the impact in the organization. And those are the things that tell you that you need to do something to help SEs be better at their jobs, not just more SEs, but how do you take the SEs that are there and help them be more successful, help them go home at night after, you know, before 7 p.m., help them not work weekends. And when you hit that moment, that's when you are at the right spot to consider a support organization.
I fully understand what you mean. I'm still trying to puzzle it together, to be honest, because now I'm thinking, you rightfully say, what do we have in SaaS business? We have an AE-SE ratio, maybe 1:3, 1:4, 1:5. I've seen cases of 1:10, like in the SMB market or so.
Yep.
So that those are the typical ranges we see. Now, as you rightfully say, and this is, I don't want to start building silos here, but it's maybe in the natural way of working that yes, AEs are demanding our capacity and they will do so in any case. And I'm now wondering, there's also an element of making sure that an SE is working on the right opportunities and it's qualified and it fulfills certain checkboxes before we say we give you that capacity to work on your deal with this SE. So you will always have the case of having more demand. Is there maybe certain KPIs or something that can very concretely tell me this is something I need to consider?
Yeah, I would say one of the things you can do, and I'm hesitating because it's something really useful and it's also something very burdensome, which is activity tracking for pre-sales.
Yes.
We tracked activities for 15 years at Salesforce, yes. And never once did I see anyone do anything with that information that was particularly useful, right?
Yeah,
that's probably not fair. There were probably executives who were having long conversations about this, but for the most part, I was not privy to those conversations. But dutifully, the SEs would fill out their activities every week, and someone somewhere would roll them up, and I saw the roll-ups. Where we started to make a distinction in later years, and where I focused when having the data that we had, was how much time are SEs spending in front of the customer?
Yes.
And how much time are they spending doing everything else?
Yes.
And our theory, and I think this is probably true, our theory was that the more time an SE spends in front of a customer, the more successful the SE is and the more successful the customer is, right? SEs are clever people. They have lots of insights. They can guide a customer. They can set their expectations. I don't need to lecture you on this. So I think the ratio of customer-facing time to non-customer-facing time is what you can look at.
Yes.
And if your SEs are spending more time behind the scenes than you'd like, and I don't think there's any threshold for that, that's when a support organization might make sense because they can offload some of that non-customer facing time.
I think that's a great insight. Actually, I remember a leader conversation I had a couple of months back, and they said, we are limiting our activity tracking, but we really want to understand how much hours per week are we spending in front of customers. And for this person, this was one of the main KPIs he looks at to judge the effectiveness also of the team. That's a great example. Thank you for that. Now, I would like to understand a little bit, let's say, the entrepreneurial side of it, of let's say the business aspect of it. Maybe that can go a bit of a direction of looking at humans at capacity, but maybe you can bear with me for a second.
Mm-hmm.
My theory, or the reason why I always tell people when pre-sales is a good idea, is that you have a complex buying center, which means there's maybe 10, 15 stakeholders that you need to sort of convince that your solution is the right fit. In order to cater for these 15 people, it makes sense to match eye-to-eye level on expertise. So if you let, for example, an AE talk to someone who's super technical, they might not be able to lead that conversation eye-to-eye level, which means, hey, maybe a pre-sales resource could be the right fit here because they would be able to and therefore convince this person that we are a great fit. Now, you rightfully say SEs are a costly resource. We look at the salary reports, there's like consensus out there. They publish this once a year. I mean, this is not incentivized by them or anything like that, but I'm reading this report every year because I think it's great information. It tells you something.
It is.
SEs are earning great money in Europe and in the US. Now, if we're looking at business efficiency and we're now saying we would like to maximize the time in front of the customer of our well-paid SE resources, is there an element that the SE support function can be, and you already hinted at it, and I would like to understand it a bit better, when you say, hey, we were recruiting people from university and so on, probably those are not as expensive as a senior SE who has been doing the job for 10 years, but is then locked in the basement for 10 days to build a demo environment, right?
Yes.
You see where I'm getting at. I'm trying to understand the business impact of having such a role.
Yes. So one thing I think you should consider is that it's a really interesting role to hire people into because you're not just hiring someone who can do the work, right? Mm-hmm. Because you're hiring adjacent to an SE or a pre-sales organization, you're looking for people who have a wider view when you're recruiting. The reason I point that out is because we found that that team of sales support engineers, of SE support, was a great feeder team for the SE organization.
Yes.
Right? You're hiring pre-SEs to do the work, the less fun work, but to have exposure to the SEs who are doing the fun work, get in front of the customers, go eat dinner at fancy places and stay in exotic locations. and if you're lucky, but it gives them exposure to that role. And so you're basically priming a bunch of relatively young people toward the SE role. And once they see it, it's hard when you see how SEs live and how awesome their lives are and how fun the job is. It's hard not to want to be an SE, unless you're more of an introvert, in which case the other place we saw a lot of value was feeder team for product marketing and product management. So again, we weren't just hiring coders out of school, though some of them were more technically inclined. Mm-hmm. Some of them were brilliant coders, so I don't want to take that away from them.
Yes.
But we found that it was a great place to start them in the company. We could see their performance. We could see where their strengths were because there was a variety of work. And then usually after 2 years or 3 years in that role, they had some pretty good opportunities around the business because they had made a name for themselves in pre-sales. It's highly visible. People were singing their praises and they could go have their pick of jobs.
Yeah, this is a fantastic insight. And no matter to which SE leader I'm speaking to, the number one pain point is hiring the right talent. So I feel like this is actually solving more than just one problem of maximizing time in front of the customer with meaningful interaction, and here having a support function who helps me with that, but also actually recruiting and developing the talent to feed into positions which are really, really hard to hire.
Yeah. And imagine you can see how they function before you hire them, right? Yes. You can see if they're successful. You can watch their interactions with SEs.
Yes.
Because the most popular SE support people will be requested by the SEs. Hey, I want them to work on that.
Yes.
And many of the people who were SSEs when I started at Salesforce went on to do great things. They became SEs, or maybe some of them are vice presidents of this and that now. They've surpassed me in my career, which I'm proud of them. but you know, they were more ambitious than I ever was. But it really turned out to be a great place to observe them in adjacent to the role and to see if they would be a good fit. And they'll tell you because once they've been in that role a year or two, they know what they want to do next. They have a pretty good idea because they've been doing configuration, they've been doing slides sometimes, they've been doing strategy discussions with SEs. In some cases, they even get some FaceTime with the customer. I'm sure we could talk about that more too. But yeah, so anyway, it really primes them in a good way to know where they want to be in the business, and it helps you understand where they'd be a good fit as well.
Do you have an opinion on what is a good ratio? Let's say I have an SE organization, global organization, we have 100 SEs. How big should my support team be like?
Well, I'll tell you, I think there's no lower bound. I think any number of SE support people is useful because not every SE will use them. So I think in my career as an SE, I probably put in 5 or 6 assists, and I knew people who put in 50 or 60. Right. So different SEs use them different ways. I liked getting in the product and I found in my case, in most cases, it was easier for me to just sit there and iterate than it was to try to describe to somebody and have them iterate every 2 or 3 days. So not everyone in the organization will use them, but having anyone in the organization that an SE can turn to for help will be immediately useful. And so I think it's one of those things. You don't need to start with a team of 10. You can start with a team of 3 and you'll know right away if the demand is there to grow the team to 10. It's a good problem to have. If you have 3 people and they're constantly, there's constant requests coming in, great. Then you're doing the right thing. And if the requests that are coming in, you alluded to this before, are strategic requests, not just, oh, I don't feel like doing this, but I actually need help, or I actually don't have time to do this important thing that's for this important deal. And you can look at those requests. If it's just, some simple stuff that an SE should be able to know how to do, then you don't expand the team. But if they're really coming in with things that use the skills of that team and multiply the ability of the SE to do more work or to be in front of the customer more, then great, hire more people and build that team up until you hit a moment when you feel like you're managing the demand from the SEs.
Before you left Salesforce, what was the ratio?
I actually don't know. So I apologize for that. The team of demo engineers, call them demo engineers, who were taking requests from SEs was managed actually by Todd Jansen, so adjacent to me on another side. Mm-hmm. But I want to say for 6,000 SEs, there were I'm going to take a guess at this, like between 40 and 70. I mean, it was a fairly large number.
Okay. So roughly 10%.
Yeah, roughly 10%. And it was varying capacity. So there were strategic demo engineers and there were technical ones. And so by that time it had grown and you would involve designers or you'd involve UX people.
Yeah.
But in the early days, really any number was fine. 2 was fine. 5 was fine. If they're overburdened, great. Hire more. They're relatively inexpensive and they don't require a lot of training. You can pull them right out of school and they're already useful to you.
Right. But I think it's a great indicator. And right, of course, every situation, every company is different. But now we have already like 2 numbers that could be an indicator that it's time to think about the function first. We have the number of hours I'm spending in front of my customers. And secondly, if my team is larger than, let's say, 10 people, maybe it makes sense to dedicate one of the headcounts towards like a support function for the rest of the team.
Yeah. And keep in mind too, so we're talking right now specifically about what I call the SE assist process, which is I need an extra pair of hands on a deal. Mm-hmm. But if you're worried about that person not having enough to do, don't worry, because there's demo environment management. That's a whole job in itself. But if someone needs to part-time it, that's fine. There is tools development, someone who watches provisioning and see if they can make that better. So there's a whole field of things that they can be doing. There's support where an SE has a technical problem and they turn to someone to help them solve it. So that role can be one of many different functions. And that's why we ended up specializing though. So the team I ran ultimately was the demo architecture, demo environments, tooling, support.
Right.
And then the other side of the house was more the deal focused extra pair of hands stuff.
Oh, okay. So if I'm understanding correctly, in your case, there were actually two main teams, one focusing on demo architecture and integration and so on, and one focusing specifically on deal support.
Correct. We called the deal team deal, and we called my team scale. Just for shorthand, right? But it was good because and I think it's an important split, because if you have the same people working on deal and scale, deals are always going to take precedence. The deal's going to come in, oh, this has the highest visibility, it's super important, it's very strategic, we need all hands on deck. And so all the people who were managing and maintaining your infrastructure, your architecture, your demo environments, your tooling, get yanked off what they were doing to go work on this super important deal. So that split was really good because it meant we could firewall the team that was making everybody better, raising the level of all boats from the kind of fire drill world of deal-to-deal work.
Got it.
And so that as well, you can do that split early. You can have, you know, four people who are doing deal work, and you can have one or two people who are doing the scale work, and you still get a ton of value out of both of them without having to pull everybody into every single deal.
Now, you described now sort of the request process, right? And of course, this should probably ring familiar to many people in SaaS, because the request process is something we in pre-sales are exposed to on the receiving end in any company, basically, that has pre-sales, right? There's sellers out there, they're looking for deals, they identify opportunities, and then they say, hey, here, I need support, and they log a request. Well, mind you, in a company that already has reached that level of maturity, they will be able to log a ticket, maybe in CRM or wherever. Mm-hmm. In other cases, you get a phone call one-to-one and says, hey, Tim, next week demo, next week Tuesday, show up for a demo. And then it's a bit more unstructured. So one shape or form, there's a request process. What would you recommend if someone is considering incepting such a function? What type of communication channels would you recommend should be available to interface that team?
So I think a request process is good. It's frustrating because you just want to sit down and talk with somebody, right? And just say, hey, I need your help. Can you do this for me? And early on, typically you can. But once the team grows to a certain size, I think a request process is important. It's important for a couple of reasons. Let's talk about what happens downstream. It's important because there will be competing priorities. As a solution engineer, and I'm sure every solution engineer has heard an account executive come to them and say, this deal I need you to work on is the most important deal. It's got the highest visibility and the highest priority in the company, right?
And it will close next week.
And it will close next week. And then 22 minutes later, another AE comes to your desk and goes, this deal is the highest priority, the highest visibility.
It's funny because it's true.
It's true, right? So AEs and SEs, you know, in our defense, aren't that good at prioritizing. What I'm working on is the most important thing in my world. So a request process at least gives that organization the ability to prioritize. And if you have a manager of that team, they can put them in priority order and say this first, this second. Thing two about the request process is when we talk about, you were worried about locking these folks in the basement and leaving them to rot there. The thing too that the request process gives them is the ability to measure their impact. So how much work did I do? What was the value of the deals that I worked on? What was the level of satisfaction of the SE that engaged me? And those three things, if you have leaderboards or whatever, or even you just use that to measure their effectiveness, is a great way for that person to go make their case, the support person to make their case that they're valuable, they've made a contribution, and that they could be an SE or they can move up in the organization. So it gives them a motivation to do the job because they can see their numbers tick up on the dashboard as they do. The other part of that request process is the SE needs to have a little skin in the game. Because if I can just toss something over the wall and go, yeah, you do it, I will. And I'll just give you some kind of half information and you'll do your best. But if I have to sit down and I have to write what I want and describe it, and I have to think about what I'm trying to do, and I can't just throw it over the wall, then I'm invested in this process just a little bit. And some SEs say, come see me, right? So, you know, please do this, come see me for more detail. But it at least forces the SE to give some thought to what they're asking another human being to do. And that, I think, is what that request process is really powerful for, where the SE has to think about stuff in advance rather than just show up, throw up, and then walk away and hope that it gets done correctly. And insight on that, someone I was talking to recently in a demo engineering organization said about 50% of their time is spent going back and forth with the SE. Not in a bad way, but clarifying, sending them copies of what they've done to get their sign off on them, you know, asking questions. So about half of their time is interaction and about half of their time is building.
It's a fascinating point. The moment where you introduce additional role, right? Yes, we talked about sort of the business scalability of having pre-sales. Yes, eye to eye level with buyer stakeholders and so on. Mm-hmm. But it also introduces friction between AEs and SEs. What you're saying is it also introduces friction between SE and the SE support function, even though, of course, we are all supposed to pull into the same direction.
Yeah, it's management. I mean, it's a classic problem in a business, which is people who are good individual contributors aren't necessarily good managers. When you're giving someone instructions on what you need them to do, you're managing them in some small way.
Yeah.
And so it's a way to force people who aren't necessarily in management roles to think about what they're asking someone to do and to give them clear instruction so that they're not just saying, you know, oh, go do this thing. And then when it doesn't come back the way they wanted, they get mad because the person didn't read their mind. Yeah. So it goes both ways. And that, you know, having been an SE and being on the other side of this as well, I'm sympathetic that an SE is busy. And sometimes it takes more time to make your request than it just takes to do the darn thing yourself, in which case, maybe you should do the darn thing yourself.
Yeah, fair. Now, you said the first purpose of the request process was also to prioritize accordingly. I mean, having been an SE leader myself, I'm looking at the number of requests I got from the sales team to my team. And for me, it was quite clear. If there's a request for support, I would look at the opportunity, I would look at the size, I would look at sort of the maturity of the customer and so on, and then judge based, okay, are we prioritizing this or are we putting this further down and we're focusing on other things? What were, let's say, internal qualification criteria, so to say, that you looked at in order to prioritize whether an SE support would go through? Is it identical or does it differ?
Yeah, I think it's the same. And again, this was adjacent to the work I was doing, but because I used the team, I know what they were asking of me as an SE.
Yeah.
Deal size, deal close date. Is it a new customer or an existing customer? Depending on what the company's trying to do. At the time I was there, growth was everything. So new logos were more important. And then how much work was involved? Was it a quick job we could squeeze in today? Or was it something that was going to take 2 weeks of someone's full-time effort? And that helped determine where you were in the queue. And it also gave the management organization, support organization management, the ability to, I don't know, to kind of chide the SEs who showed up 5 days before a meeting with 2 weeks of work. Gave them the opportunity to push back a little bit and say, hey, you've just asked for something that is going to take, we're going to have to move heaven and earth to get this done. Is this really as important as you think it is? Or do we need to do this in 5 days? Or is it just lack of planning on your part? So it gives both sides the ability to negotiate a little bit on what they want. So the prioritization is driven by the same way it is in the SE world.
Yeah, I got it. What is so funny, the symptoms that you are describing are exactly the same symptoms when we talk about AE and SE collaboration. You agreed on a demo next week, Tuesday, and you're giving me your discovery notes, and maybe you did a really good job, could be the case, right? And based on that, I would take 2 weeks to actually build something meaningful together, and we have literally like 3 days.
Yep. It all rolls downhill, man.
It's so funny I think it's also a good indicator. Sometimes it's good to look into the mirror and wonder whether what you're complaining about is not something that you actually behave yourself sometimes.
And I get it. We're myopic. And especially in sales. Sales attracts narcissists, and I'm one of them, right? It attracts people who are deadline driven and who are driven by the attention and possibly the money. And SEs are, you know, a step away from a direct salesperson, but they're still very much in the game. So I get it. My deal is the most important deal. It always will be. And so sometimes you just need some coaching. And I like to think of it that way. There's pushback, but there's also like, hey, we'll do it this time for you. Mm-hmm. But next time you really need to give us more warning. And, you know, SEs are smart people. They'll figure out, I'm not going to get any more favors from this organization unless I play by their rules. So it doesn't mean they just close the door on them, but it means there's a conversation there and that you have kind of evidence of both sides of that discussion. Yeah.
So now I was coming from the communication channels and the first thing you said was, hey, of course, there is sort of like a formal way to log the request and then the SE support team will prioritize and accordingly and so on. We talked about it. Are there other channels that were available to interface with your team? Like, for example, like a Slack channel where you could ask a quick question, or was there also a way to just call them if you needed a quick answer or something? What other things were there?
Yeah. So if you're willing to leave aside the team now that did the deal focused stuff, mm-hmm. now you're getting back into my world, which is the, I would say, interfaced with deals, but the scale stuff.
Yes.
So I had four teams. I'll get to your answer in a moment. I had four teams. I had a team of people who managed demo environments, mm-hmm. specifically a team of people who built tools to automate common SE tasks. Mm-hmm. I had a team of people who were re-architecting the demo environments because we were having some challenges with the scalability of them. And we can talk about that. That's where the patent came from, if you remember my patent. Not my patent, a patent that was generated for my team. And the fourth team, getting to your question, was a support team specifically for solution engineers. So it was not a deal support team. It was a team of people who, If you had a technical problem with your demo environment, they could help you hunt it down and figure out what's going on. The team could answer your questions about when is a particular feature coming down the pipe. They could go interface with product management and go ask them. They could find out if a new feature was going to be implemented in the demo soon. They could answer questions about other tools that the SEs used or other processes. Hey, who do I talk to about this thing? So we had a team of, I think it was six people. Their whole job was to sit on the Slack channel. Initially, it was tickets, and then we moved to Slack when we purchased Slack. Their job was to handle SE requests in the heat of battle, right? So an SE is out there in the field and something's gone wrong. They have someone to turn to who doesn't go, have you tried rebooting? But says, I know you're an SE, right? I know you're smart. I know you've tried all the obvious things. Let's see if we can help you with this more complex.
Okay, got it. Really nice. All right. So that actually provided some clarity in what your team in general were doing. And maybe it's worthwhile to just talk about the different four different aspects that you just mentioned. Well, on the fourth one, we already have some clarity. The first one you said was, and if I remember correctly, you said basically building demo environments was the task or the main responsibility of the first team. And I want to quote some because I found this quite cool how you've written this up. And by the way, anyone who's listening, I would really recommend check out the LinkedIn profile of Micah. He has, in his job description, I think nailed what it means to talk about value-based contributions. We all talk about, like, these talk tracks, they happen all the time, right? Our software is so efficient and we are so effective, blah, 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 AI insights and so on, all that nonsense. But you really put it down to number, what your contributions were. And I want to read out one piece because that struck me quite, I was quite impressed. Equipped 6,000 SEs with scalable platform for delivering 433,000 live product demos each year.
Yeah,
I mean, those are numbers you have to digest.
Yeah, the scale, I'm often shocked by the scale we were operating at. When I think about, when they let little old me be in charge of all that, I was like, what are you doing? Why are you letting me do this? This is important to the business. Yeah, so let's talk about that. So thank you. Thank you for using my own words against me. Salesforce had, when I started managing the demo environment 9 years ago now, there was one. It was called the Simple Demo Org. It was anything but simple, but it was a single demo environment that pretty much every demo
contained everything,
wall to wall, Salesforce. And that worked for a while, but Salesforce started acquiring companies. And not all those companies had quite the same architecture Salesforce did. So there were two demo environments. And then the Simple Demo Org was too complicated. And so we created the Clean Demo Org, which was an empty demo org that had everything configured, but nothing really in it, mm-hmm. so that your platform SEs could use it. And then we created Everybody's Demo Org to enable account executives to be able to demo, and even customers could demo to themselves using Everybody's Demo Org. And then we had the DXDO, which was the developer, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, so we had those. We had a series of demo environments that were each separate columns. And each of those demo environments needed some level of maintenance. And then there was a team adjacent to me, my close colleague, Valerie Haas, who managed the industry demo environments. So for finance and healthcare and transportation. And so each of those was also a separate demo environment. So we had, there were probably 15 demo environments. I managed about 7 of the core ones, and Val's team managed another 7 or 8 of these industry demo environments. And so each of those kind of was a full-time job. I mean, just about all of those demo environments required a person on them, because every time a new product came out, you had to implement that product in all of these demo works.
Yes.
And then you had to come up with a scenario that worked for the particular industry or scenario or use case. So it was an expensive organization. And this is one of the reasons we changed later, why I had that separate team that I talked about doing the re-architecting, where we went to a modular model. And I'll talk about them more if you want. But in essence, we had this organization where there were individual people personally accountable for each demo environment. And it was great because if I'm half-timing a demo environment, you know, other things will take precedence over. But if my whole job is to make sure that the demo environment that I produce, the people using it, is good, and that's how I'm measured and that's how I'm assessed, you get some really quality work. And so that team was full of really high-functioning people who did amazing work making these demo environments tell a story and get everything configured and get everything set to go.
How do you measure that a demo environment is satisfying the needs of the people in the field?
Surveys. So we did a survey every 6 months and said, what do you think of this demo environment?
Okay.
And, you know, which ones do you use? What do you think of them? What do you think of the quality? They save you time. How much time do they save you? It was mostly qualitative. There were also, that team also had metrics, the industry's team in particular, kind of like time from release of a product to the time it was implemented in the org, in the demo environment. My team, we just aimed for the fastest time possible. If we could get the product into the demo environment on the day it was released, the day it was GA, then we won. And if it took a month or two after that to get it fully implemented, then it was still okay. But we were pushing always toward getting product in the hands of the SEs as soon as possible.
Got it. Now, you said something, getting AEs to also demo. What's the secret tech?
Oh, yeah, this is hot right now, especially when we talk about buyer enablement. It's you know, the AEs between you and the customer in a lot of the cases. AEs are like thoroughbred horses, right? They're fast and their legs break really easily. And so you need to care for them. And I could never do an AE's job. In fact, I know a couple of SEs who got annoyed because they're like, I'm doing all the work and the AE's making all the money. And they switched over to becoming an AE and they were successful, but they didn't all like the job very much. And I feel the same. I don't ever want to be an account executive. I respect what they do. I could never do it. I could never go to someone's bedside, you know, at the hospital on New Year's Eve to go get them to sign a contract, right? I'm just not wired that way. So when I roll my eyes about account executives, it's with respect. I can't do that job. I never will. But some SEs very much feel like they can and they try, and some of them are successful. But most of the feedback I've heard is that they're not excited about it. I'm totally sorry. I lost the thread of our conversation. No, what was your question?
it's all good. It's good context, right? Yeah. And my question was, how do we get AEs to demo more?
Yes, thank you. So AEs are busy and they have a lot on their plate and they're under a great deal of pressure from sales management. So the way we found to get AEs to demo was first find the AEs who needed to demo, mm-hmm. which were generally small business, medium-sized business AEs who couldn't get access to resources because the ratio of sales engineers to AEs was 6-1 or something. So find your audience first, figure out who's doing it, figure out who's demoing already. And we could see that. We could see who was downloading and setting up the demos, knew who our audience was. Talk to them, see what they're struggling with. And then what we built was a demo environment that was completely pre-configured. It was live, it wasn't fake, and it depends. I feel strongly about live demos. I think demos should be live. It's not always necessary, but in this case, we were able to do it. It was an open demo environment. It wasn't on Rails. The AE could show anything they wanted, right. But it was locked down so they couldn't make changes. It was a shared environment where everybody felt like they were in there by themselves. They had their own data set that they could change, but they couldn't make configuration changes. And what we did, which I'm particularly proud of, and this is some great work by a gentleman named Hanul Park, who instrumented the demo environment with guidance so that when you logged in, it said, here's what this is, here's what this is, here's what you talk about.
Like pop-up screens
pop-ups,
that guide you through it.
That you could go through the whole demo, and when you were done, you could turn it off,
right.
And you could use the same demo environment in front of a customer. It just, all of that stuff was gone. It worked really well.
It's basically like having a demo script that is embedded in the software itself.
Yes.
And you can turn it on and off.
I call it just-in-time knowledge. Because if you teach someone a month and a half before they need it, they'll forget. So when I log in and I want to see what this new product does, I go in, it tells me what it's all about. It gives me some positioning and I can demo it in a few minutes.
I love that.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. It's funny that it's still a topic that needs to be discussed. But just last week, I was speaking to a country manager of a cybersecurity firm, and he was telling me, hey, for us, whenever there is an AE opportunity, they always in the first meeting already ask for SE support. They always want to show the demo in the first meeting. I was like, are these the type of problems we are still talking about today in 2024? Haven't we learned anything in the past 10, 20 years? Oh. And that's such an elegant solution where hopefully, I mean, in the end, I loved how you started the story. You start speaking to the AEs who are already doing it. Obviously, those are not the ones you need to convert from a mindset perspective. They already believe in it, that it makes sense for them to be able to show at least something in those first meetings. And then, of course, it becomes a topic of just making it as easy as possible for them. And hopefully, by that means, also making it more accessible to the others who maybe today feel a bit, let's say they have a respect for it, which is also fine, right? They sometimes don't want to make anything, they don't want to break it, and they are maybe a little bit afraid of it. And I think the solution that you just discussed can lower the barrier.
Very much. It was an environment that they couldn't screw up. And if they did, they could call us. We maintained the environment. We managed the underpinnings of it. So if something went horribly wrong, they could let us know. And the other side of that, which I think is a larger conversation, is, and I was against this initially, and I'm still not 100% sure this was a good idea, but it worked out fine, which was, we looked and went, well, if an AE can give this demo, a customer can give this demo. So we created a separate profile just for customers,
okay,
where they could sign up on a webpage. You can go there now. It's salesforce.com/EDO, everybody's demo org. And you can sign up for this thing.
Yes.
And a customer can log in and can see all these products and see all the guidance and everything, a subset of what an AE can see because some of the products are new and not released. And they themselves can run themselves through a demo and can also use that to do demos inside their organization. They can go be a champion for Salesforce and have the power in their hands to do a Salesforce demo.
Yes.
The reason I was against it is just it just raises the risk level a lot. We really need to nail exactly right. Whereas for SEs, a little bit of wiggle room if it goes wrong. But, you know, Salesforce was a pretty robust platform, so we didn't have a lot of outages or anything. Mm-hmm. So, you know, 99.999% of the time, the thing was running fine. And occasionally there was a hiccup when we noticed, you know, something that had escaped our notice. But there was, you know, we had a lot of security in place. Anyway, the important thing was, I think there's something to consider around enabling your buyers, enabling your customers. And a customer is not that different from an AE from a skill level standpoint mm-hmm. around technology mm-hmm. in most businesses.
You said something earlier, which I would like really to pick apart. You mentioned earlier, you are a big fan of live systems. Mm-hmm. Now, you emphasized that these systems were robust, so there's very little chance that they break. Immediately, in my mind, it's triggering, why not just using demo automation and providing your customer with an interface like that, where you are not reliant on a live system because it just works technically a whole different level. Why are you a fan of live systems?
I don't know that I have a philosophical angle on this. I think I'm just lucky. I think from in the early days, before I worked at Salesforce, I worked at a number of other companies, and the products were more temperamental. And it wasn't necessarily the product's fault. You know, to do a demo, you had to slip a new hard drive into your laptop and your, you know, and hope that what was on the hard drive was still working because it was a server instance, right? And you'd ghost these hard drives. And there were a lot of moving parts. And so in my early days as an SE and I was an industry marketing manager, I remember doing this. I built what I called my HTML demo, which at the time HTML and CSS was all there was. And you could click through and it looked like you were doing a live demo. It was just screenshots with hotspots, right?
Yes, exactly.
And so I'm all for that conceptually. I will say though, once we get into enterprise software, I feel like it's important for the customer to see something that's real. I don't know why. I just feel like it feels more sincere. It feels more credible to show somebody what it looks like when they get it versus on Rails. Oh, don't click there. Oh, we can't do that. And as an SE, I had a lot of confidence that when I clicked on something that I hadn't prepared, that it would take me somewhere I meant for it to go. You know, yeah. Oh, what does that button do? I don't know. Let's find out. So I think I was lucky. I was working for a company where the platform was quite robust and quite reliable, and I felt pretty confident about it.
Yeah.
Whether that's true for every company, I don't know. I like the idea of live demos. I think customers like live demos. I think they like the risk of live demos. I think they like the showmanship of live demos, right? I think there's something, when customers want a demo, they're excited to see you fail. And when you don't, they're slightly disappointed, but they're also pleased because if they buy this, they'll have a positive experience. So I can't say that I have a good reason for it, except just it's kind of where I came from.
So what I was hearing is a live environment is better at suspending disbelief that what you're looking at is fake.
Yeah.
That's what I heard. And I think there is definitely an element for it. I can see the reasoning. I think what I'm wondering is, to what degree does that help you or does not help you in actually closing the deal by removing that skepticism that might be there if you're just presenting screenshots that are clickable?
I'll be the first to say the best demo is no demo. If you can close a deal without a demo, that's amazing. Like, that's the best possible. And I stole that because I had a salesperson tell me the best sales process has two steps, qualify, close, right? It doesn't have 19 steps in it. So I think you're absolutely right. If there are other things that will satisfy the customer and will move the deal forward, then you should do those things.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm taking a step back from my, you know, my sort of zealot position on everything should be live. I feel like when we finally say this is a demo, it should be live. But there's 100 things. There's whiteboards, there's click-throughs, there's, you know, consensus is a great example of like videos. Yeah. There's lots you can do before that moment that the customer needs to see the live product that may well advance the deal without you having to do all the work. Because demos are expensive. They take a lot of time. They take a lot of effort. They're scary, right? So if you can avoid a demo, do it. But if you're going to do a demo, I feel just in my heart of hearts that it should be the real.
Fair enough. I mean, I think the key question behind that one is whether the customer will even be able to tell the difference. And that is a nuance that you probably cannot judge from the outside. There will be people at your prospect who see the URL and they think, well, this is obviously a fake system. And then others who won't even look at that, they just interact with it. They don't press any funny buttons. They will say, hey, this is perfectly fine. But I think in general, I'm also a huge fan of giving customers, prospects in general, access to our software in some very low barrier form. I love that the example that you gave with Salesforce and that URL where everyone can go to and just click some demo org to see what's going on. Because I think we still spend too much time in customer-facing meetings just showing our software. I think this can, to some extent at least, be done in an asynchronous way.
Yeah.
So why, if we have a 60-minute meeting with a customer and that time is rare, those are 60 minutes that need to be meaningful. Is it really meaningful if I rattle off our most fan favorite features in the first 20 minutes? Or should we rather talk about really what are your challenges? What are the consequences those lead to? And is it really worthwhile considering redoing a project here? I think that would be the more meaningful conversation as opposed to we just would like to see what you're doing.
Yeah.
Because that you can do asynchronously. Here's a video, here's a click path demo, whatever you want to call it. Anything that obviously sounds as believable as possible to the prospect. I think that's a very valuable to have.
Yeah, I would agree. I was thinking about your Disco deck, which I think is amazing. It does a great job of giving an SE a framework to do discovery. I think one of the questions I would add, and I don't know if it's in there, so if it is, forgive me, but how do you want to be sold, right?
Yeah,
how do you, what do you need to see? Because sometimes you'll say, what do you need to see? And they'll go, I just need to see some screens. Okay, I'll show you some screens, right? Oh, well, we're going to bring in the IT guy and he's going to want to see everything. Okay, well, now I know it needs to be a demo. But I think it's okay to ask the customer, well, what do you need? Or what does your boss need to see, right? Yes. Do they need to see the whole thing? Or can we just like send a PowerPoint deck with some slides in it with some screenshots? And the customer will tell you. I think they'll be honest with you about what they think is necessary.
For me, that's you mentioned the word earlier. For me, that's the essence of buyer enablement, understanding what your customer needs to make an educated decision. And if part of that is a two-day demo workshop, okay, well, let's discuss it in detail, what is really required there. If the requirement is to go through the security questionnaire and show you a couple of screens and one use case, well, by all means, let's do that, right? Just because our process has 19 steps in it doesn't mean that every customer requires it because, well, what do they need to make an educated decision is the most important question, I believe, today.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think, and this is something I do feel strongly about, is a demo is a bargaining chip. Customers like demos. Customers love demos. It's the most interesting part of the day, right? They see something live.
Yes.
They see something
new.
It's new. It's risky, right? It's a show. They get to hope that something goes wrong so they can prove that they're right. And it, not in any malicious way, but it's like seeing a live stage production, right? You could go watch a movie, but everything's been edited. You go watch things on stage because they're exciting, because something could go wrong. And so I think we should use demos as a bargaining chip, as a way to move the deal forward. And we do, but it shouldn't be, oh, you want a demo? You get a demo. It's great. We'd love to do a demo for you. Here's what's going to happen before. Here's what I'm hoping will happen after. Let's all agree to that. Upfront contract stuff, right?
I love that.
So the customers love demos and they will do things to get a demo. And when we give them a demo, it should be pretty good.
Since we are on the topic, what do you think about the book a demo button on pretty much 90% of SaaS websites?
Yeah. For a small company just getting started, it may be the only way for people to get their eyes on things. But it drives me crazy because I want to see it now. I don't want to have to interact with a human being to use your software that you claim is going to prevent people from having to interact with human beings. So I like to at least clap eyes on the product and develop my own understanding of what it is before you commit me to talking to a person. Also, I think solution engineers, we are in sales, and so we know when we're being sold to. I think we're very sensitive to it. When you're in sales, you know when you're being sold to and you know when you're about to be sold to. And clicking that book a demo button, you know you're going on a mailing list. You know someone's going to call you. You know they're going to bother you. You know you're going to get 5 emails over the next 3 weeks about...
I think by now everyone knows that.
We know that, right?
Not just sales, but yeah.
but it hurts us. You know, it hurts us more. But yeah, I think we sense that. And I think customers sense that very much. And so they're hesitant to commit. I would just rather show me what you have. I'll make a decision. And if I'm really interested, I'll engage a human being.
Thanks for sharing your perspective on that. All right. So we talked about the first part of your team who is fundamentally responsible for maintaining and creating demo environments.
Yep.
Let's move to the second piece, which
tooling.
What did tooling do or what does tooling do?
Tooling, with all due respect to the demo environments, because that was where I came from, tooling was definitely my favorite part of the business. And the concept behind the tooling was you go ask your SEs, what's the thing that takes you longest that you hate doing the most? And they tell you.
Can you give an example?
I hate filling my demo with industry-specific data. I hate branding my portal. I hate configuring the product because it takes an hour to configure the product for every demo because I need to load it with a whole bunch of stuff and make all the configuration changes. And so you find out what SEs are spending their time on that they'd rather not be. And then you go get a developer or several developers to build a solution that solves that problem. Let's make a tool that will, if you press a button that says, Healthcare, it'll dump a healthcare data set into your demo environment and you're 90% of the way there. Make a button that when you click it, it pre-configures this new product with all the buttons and switches that need to be done so you don't have to go through the documentation and do it yourself, right? And in some cases, so building tools that save SEs time. And the reason I was really passionate about it was because we could measure the direct impact we were having on the business. I would look at a manual process and SE would say, I hate loading data. Great. I would sit down with an environment and I would load data the same way an SE would with a stopwatch. Mm-hmm. And I'd start it when I started and I'd stop it when I stopped. And then we'd build a tool. And if you could click a button and it would do that work, let's say half an hour, then every time someone clicked that button, you save the organization half an hour. And if 10,000 people click that button this year, that's, I don't know, that's like 5,000 hours, which is about 2.5 years of SE time. And if you multiply that by an SE salary, that's like $500,000, right?
So I'm going to quote your LinkedIn profile once again. Surely you have it on here. And I really love the way you put it. Designed automated configuration tools, which reduced SE workload by 480,000 hours, saving $42 million.
Click by click. Every click that an SE did, and not all tools were half an hour savings. Some were like 2 minute savings and some were 10 minutes and some were 2 hours. But that number I can defend to my grave because every time someone clicked a button, we put a check in a database and we had a number next to it that said the amount of time that we believe it saved. And then we'd total that each quarter and we'd just go browbeat management with us.
What was the tool or is the tool that saves the most time?
Ooh, that depends. So I would say the tool that saved the most time, there were two. Both of them were developed by a gentleman named Tarandeep Singh, and one was called Demo Boost and one was called Demo Wizard. Mm-hmm. Demo Boost was a tool that when you created a new demo environment, there were a bunch of tasks you needed to do. There were just things about the copying process of demo environments that just you needed to do manually. And this tool would go through. When you first logged in, the screen would come up and say, we're doing these things for you now, and we will email you when you're done. And then the screen would go away. And about 10 minutes later, you get an email and said, this batch job was done. This thing was turned on. This thing was turned off. This thing was configured. And we estimated that thing was saving SEs 2 hours per demo, something like that. Yeah. Because we'd add up each task it was doing and then we'd just multiply.
Of course.
So that was a really big one. And then the second was Demo Wizard, which is things that required interaction. Things that maybe I don't want to do this. And one of my favorites was called Perfect Date Wizard, which was click a button and it will change all the dates in my demo environment. So every case was open in the last 10 days. Every opportunity is closing in the next 30. Every contract is active. Every marketing campaign is active. So it just went through and changed all the dates and made everything look super current.
So you're not there in 2024 demoing data from 2019 and saying, hey, look at this recent campaign we did. Oh, by the way, that's 5 years ago.
Right. You pull up a chart and half of it's missing, right? So it was just a little thing. And in fact, that was developed even before I started in the job. But what we did is we took the code that an SE had developed called Perfect Date Wizard and we put it on the new platform and we generalized it. So you could add, as new products came out, you could just add them into the Perfect Data for this. So they're really amazing. And it was fun. My favorite tool was named Click, Click, Boom.
I was about to ask, what was your favorite? Irrespective of the time it was saved.
My favorite tool is called Click, Click, Boom. And it was literally you click and it was kind of like Demo Boost. Like I talked about, it was the earlier version of Demo Boost. Okay. But you click this button and it would go, I've done this, I've done this, I've done this, I've done this, I'm done. What I liked about it, and I think this is important to note, when you do automation, I think you should tell the people that you're automating things for what you've done for them. Because one, they're interested to know. SEs want to know what you're doing to their demo environment. But two, it just reminds them that you have their back. It reminds them that there's someone out there who's doing their work for them and making their lives easier. And so we didn't need an interface for these things. It could have just happened behind the scenes.
Right.
But we felt it was important to tell SEs, hey, this thing that you normally would have had to do yourself, we've done for you. You're welcome. And I think
we saved you 30 minutes.
Saved you 30 minutes. Go on with your day. Have a nice week. So that kind of communication was important. And it was fun to give things catchy names because, you know, they kind of enjoyed knowing the product names, clicking on something.
Yes.
So we had tools like that. And then we had much more technical tools that were product specific, configurators for CPQ. And we had a data tool that allowed you to generate data and dump it in your environment. So there were a whole bunch of things that had other uses that saved SEs a lot of time.
So I think everything that you talked about in the past 10 minutes, I mean, I can only speak from my perspective, but I'm assuming many, many SEs out there are thrilled by even the idea that something like that exists, because everything that you talked about, every single use case is a pain point I had as an SE. I remember at one company, without disclosing the name, it was a pain in the butt to just get a system provisioned and set everything up. And I was always wondering, when I click new environment here, why do I have to go through this 20-step process afterwards to actually just bring it to a status where I can even start working with it?
Right.
I haven't even loaded any data in it. There is nothing in there just to actually getting started.
Yep.
It already took half a day. And I mean, never mind. I can still remember I used like random name generators, mm-hmm. address generators, and all the bunch using Excel loaders to just put something in.
Yep.
I mean, if you're lucky, your solution has an Excel loader. If you're unlucky, you have to use the GUI because the database access is even something that is more complicated because you have to program something,
yeah.
which may be not something everyone is up to. So my heart was warming up.
Good. Yeah. And this is why I'm passionate about this, because you're exactly right. These are pain points. These are very real pain points. And they cost the business money. You know, they're wasting time. And an SE is too busy to do some of these things. And what'll happen is they simply won't do it. I won't correct the dates in my demo. I won't load all the data. I'll put in the data for two screens. And if we go off those screens, I'm just going to have to kind of dance a little bit or apologize that it's not been customized.
Yeah.
So some of these, and this is why it was a little hard to measure impact, because like changing all the dates, yeah, it'd probably take me 15 minutes to change the dates on three screens I'm going to show,
yeah.
but it would have taken me hours to change them everywhere. But yes, this is why I was passionate about it too, because I could click by click, I could see the impact we were having on the organization. And people loved the tools. People raved about them. And when they came from other companies and said, oh my gosh, you have automated all this? And I'd kind of pat myself on the back, and our team was doing amazing work. Some really clever developers doing really amazing stuff.
There is maybe one example I can share from one of my previous employers where we surveyed our customers. And those were like enterprise customers with tens of thousands, sometimes even way bigger than that, of users partially. And we were gathering data from them. Of course, not every user would answer, but there were instances where we had hundreds of responses to these type of surveys. And what we would normally do is completely manually go through them, consolidate them, bring them together, and so on. And we had one member on the team who put together basically an automated tool to analyze, consolidate, and summarize all the findings basically with the click of a button. So as opposed to reading the whole morning, 3 hours of like hundreds of responses from a particular survey, we literally could do it in 5 minutes. And it was, I would say, like 80% there. There was still some yep. data to be manually reviewed, so to say, but it basically was 90% saved.
This to me is the power of demo automation. I say demo because it was my field.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, automation where you find something that's taking a lot of people a lot of time,
yes.
and you just stop it in its tracks. You yeah. just do it for them. Well, what I like about it, and I think what the developers on my team enjoyed about it was never the same challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And often they had to kind of use undocumented APIs. They had to come up with clever solutions because some things you had to do manually. So how can we do this manually? How can we use a tool like a robots tool that will go through the browser and just do this behind the scenes while the SE is getting a cup of coffee? So there were a lot of really clever solutions we had to come up with to automate these things, which weren't always meant to be automated. Not everything had an API that allowed you to switch on
yes.
a new product once you enabled it, right?
Yes.
So there were a lot of really challenges. And I think the developers enjoyed these challenges because it wasn't just do another thing like this, do another thing like this. It was solve this thorny problem. Okay, you need to check a box over here in the product, but there's no way to get to it without actually navigating the product itself. See if you can come up with a solution. And they would.
So you mentioned clever solutions. It seems like some of these solutions were so clever that we have to talk about your patents or the patents that you and the team developed.
Yeah. I can't take credit for this. There's a lesson in here, but let me start with what it was and then I'll talk about the lesson. So what it was, problem we were having at Salesforce is we had, as I mentioned before, these separate demo environments, each of which was a column that required at least a full-time person and sometimes two to manage that whole demo environment.
Yes.
And my team was focused more on what I would call the core, kind of what's common across all of these things. And a gentleman named Jesse Chase came to me one day, a guy on my team, and said, hey, I think I have a solution, but I'm not sure it's going to work, but I've kind of demoed it out and I think it works. And his idea was to break these demo columns, these demo kind of monoliths, each demo environment, into little modular pieces, and then build up a demo from modular pieces from scratch, rather than starting at the big column and then having to whittle it away until it was what you wanted. The problem we were having is a new product would come out. We would implement it in the core demo environment, and then it would take the industry demos 4 or 5 months to get all of those things into their new demo environment.
A new product or one of the acquisitions that Salesforce has undergone throughout
yeah,
the years.
Yeah, exactly. So some new thing had to be put in the demo. So we'd put it in first and then hand it off to them, and they'd rebuild their demos based on all these new products and put all the new data back on it. It was taking months. And so what we figured out was, why don't we have those teams only manage their own content? They would have to re-implement. Why don't they all just manage, if you're the finance vertical, just manage finance content, finance settings, finance metadata, and we'll manage the core itself. And by building it up out of components, yes, we could rebuild the core, hand the core off to them, and they could just snap in their top pieces. I'm oversimplifying this.
But
it's working. And I'm happy to say that even after having left Salesforce, that program we developed is working. This modular demo thing is really taking off. And the only problem with it is it's straining the infrastructure because there's like millions of calls a day on these things, right?
Mm, okay.
So there's a scalability conversation we could have. But the patent was around some deeply technical aspects of this modularization, of how you communicate with the servers and how you tell them what's coming. So I can't go into detail because quite honestly, I don't know all the details, but a gentleman named Stuart Anderson and Radif Masood were the two who did this. The lesson in this, which I think is really interesting, is the way we ended up getting these patents applied for is Salesforce, probably like many other companies, has a team of lawyers whose whole job it is to find patentable things inside a company. And one day I asked these guys, we were in a meeting, and I said, hey, is anything we're doing, you know, patentable? And they went, I don't know. And so we contacted legal, and the guy or lady who we were talking to looked through the work we were doing and presented a couple of the projects they were working on. They found two things that they felt were patentable. And I think that's an interesting thing. It hadn't really occurred to me before that. But what we were trying to do in our team of tooling and of architecture is not like anything that any customer will ever do with your product.
Yeah.
We're solving new problems. You're not supposed
it's a very
to.
Unique problem.
Yeah, it's a unique problem. No customer is going to load, you know, different data in a thousand times a week, right?
This is just for the sake of being efficiently demoing and working and go to market. Yeah.
Totally. So you're solving really fairly obscure problems a lot of the time. And so I would say to anyone listening to the podcast, you know, look at the work you're doing. And if you do have a legal team that's focused on patents, go talk to them about something that you're doing that's interesting. Because they'll tell you if it's worth patenting. But the company likes patents. The company wants to patent things. They can license them later if they become useful.
Mm-hmm.
So your team may already be doing something that's patentable. And it's just really nice. It's cool to have a patent to your name. Those two developers I talked about, their names are on the patent. Mine is not. I'm just management. But their names are on the patent. And someday when that patent is finally approved, it's in process now, they'll be able to say, I have patent number XXX on your mind. So it's just it's a very motivating thing. And you might be surprised. You might be even more innovative than you thought you were.
I mean, fair enough. It's a very unique problem. Nevertheless, I mean, the purpose of a patent, I mean, I'm not a patent expert, but my understanding of a patent is that you sort of protect the intellectual property where you have put a lot of sweat, blood, and tears into it to say, hey, this belongs to me and potentially you can use it, but then we need to talk about maybe a price tag against it and so on, license it out, as you put it. All right. So we talked about the demo environments. We talked about the tooling.
Yep.
There's a third and the fourth piece. Please remind me again.
Yeah. So we talked about support a little bit, which is the fourth.
Yes, what I'm calling that was the fourth piece. What was the third one?
The third one was a bit of what we just talked about now, this re-architecting, modularization.
Okay.
But I think there's a bigger conversation we can have about that, particularly when we're talking about enterprise, when we're talking about large scale things. So this particular team was, we called it the next generation demo team, and their whole job was to look at our scalability and figure out how to solve the problems of the future. And they did this through modularization. But what I would say is, as you're building tools as well, and the tooling team had to do this also, is build tools with an eye to the future. There will be problems, there will be new challenges in the future that you don't anticipate, but you can anticipate that there will be new challenges in the future. So for example, don't hard code the user interface of your tool, make it expendable or expandable, make it extensible.
Coding and bad coding.
Right. Assume that the conditions will change. The products that the company sells will change. The challenges that they're facing will change. The things that SEs need will change. And just assume from the outset that things will change. And then if you build an extensible architecture for your tooling and for your demos, that will hopefully be able to accommodate those changes. Make it possible to snap things into your interface that, you know, your demo wizard interface that steps people through things.
Yeah.
Make it possible for other people outside your organization to contribute tools that snap in your framework.
For example?
So for example, a product manager building a new product, we provided them with APIs to our tools and they could provide us with code that we could run that would pre-configure their product when they put it into the demo. And so they have all the expertise, they have all the undocumented APIs. In a lot of cases, they were trying to get the product to market before all the documentation was there, which is fine, that's a thing. And so it made it possible for people outside our organization to contribute to the tooling. And then where that got really interesting is where we interfaced with the support team that I was talking about, the SE support team of all the people working on deal focused stuff.
Yes.
And started incenting that team to contribute automation tools to our platform.
Right.
So now we had, rather than the six developers that I had on my team, we had somewhere between 40 and 70 people, any of whom could propose a tool and could get the documentation and could build tooling for it. So it made it extensible. And it made it possible for us to continue to meet new challenges as they came to us, rather than having to wait and go, oh yeah, I wish we had made something that could accommodate that. So right from the beginning, and we didn't do this right the first time, it took a couple of generations, but by about the third or fourth time we were building these tools, we finally figured out, let's build an extensible framework so that the next thing that comes along, because there will be, we can just click it in there and serve it up to the SEs quickly instead of having to build the whole thing from scratch.
I think that's a great lesson to be learned here. I mean, I can remember in basically any SE organization I've been a part of, there have always been like one or two people who are really keen to develop these internal processes and make something better because it's inherently in them. But I also remember a couple of prime examples where from the next product release, and we're talking SaaS here, right? So product releases are not really a thing anymore. It's basically every week there's a new feature,
yeah.
Right? All of a sudden it deteriorates and becomes not useful anymore because things have changed. So thanks for sharing that lesson with us.
And I think you hit on a really interesting point as well. And I don't know if this is going to win me any friends, but the idea of standardization, there are different kinds of people. Different kinds of people are solution engineers. Different kinds of people are salespeople. The idea of forcing everybody into a standard, like here's the standard demo. I understand the idea of having a standard, but when we do like certifications and we do every SE should be structured this way and here's how we want you to approach things, I find that those are less often successful for exactly this reason. Some SEs love to code. Some SEs, I don't code. I never went to school for code. Like I love to sell. I love the demo. I love the story, right? And we can be successful in our own ways. And there's not one way to be successful.
Yes.
So that's just me standing on my soapbox. But I think it's important when we talk about things like demo consistency, we're not trying to stop anyone. We're just trying to raise the level of all boats. We just want to make everyone a little better. The people who are already good, great. They're good. They can keep being good in their own way. So I just wanted to get that out. I feel better.
I think you hit on a point here. And maybe that's one of the reasons why our role has so many different names, right? You have solution architects, you have pre-sales consultants, you have sales engineers and everything in between and any type of combination out of that. And maybe that reflects also the diversity of what the role entails, which we all so dearly love.
Yeah, it's hard to say, well, what makes a good SE? I mean, persistence. But beyond that, the best SEs I knew were all very different from each other. Some were really good relationship people. Some were really technical.
Yeah.
Some were neither, like me. Yeah. But they all had their own style and they all brought something really interesting to it. I liked interfaces. I liked UI and UX. And so that, you know, I could be helpful on that front. And if I paired up with someone who liked coding, and a colleague and I did that, we made a CTI connector that, you know, like a demo CTI thing, and it worked great. But neither of us had similar views of how to sell or how the world worked.
There has been a random question in my mind since we started this conversation, and I think I missed the point where I should have asked the question. So I'm just going to do randomly now,
sure.
Because I think it's a lot of SE's mind, and it certainly has been on my mind. It's maybe a minor detail, but you can give me your opinion on it. When you're building out a demo environment, and I've just talked earlier about the random name generators to load up my demo data and so on, blah, blah. And of course, this is a topic that you have really deeply thought about. What I used to do when I was a young, innocent SE, I would use things like Tony Stark and Superman usernames and funny images and stuff like that to load my demo environments. What is your view on fake demo data?
I dislike it. So thumbs down from me. So I think it's distracting and I think it suggests laziness. And while I would never call any SEs lazy, it feels lazy when you see that someone just came up with some things off the top of their mind. I've seen some brilliant demos that were intentionally built around fictional people, like Santa Claus delivering gifts or, you know, Tony Stark running Stark Industries.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's fine. And I think that can be very engaging, mm-hmm, if the customer is the right kind of customer.
Right.
But I spent a lot of time, more time than I'm proud to admit, on the core data sets that we used in our demo environments and coming up with plausible sounding companies,
yeah,
plausible sounding people, and importantly, a diverse set of people.
Mm-hmm.
Or it turns out in Japan, a diverse set of people isn't what sells. Everyone needs Japanese names, right?
Yes.
And Japanese photos and their user profiles.
Yes. Yeah.
So, but making sure that we were representing a wide range of types of customers and types of people that felt sincere and felt credible rather than, hey, here's some funny things I thought of 10 minutes before the demo.
So you left Salesforce in August 2023. So that is already well within the new age of AI. Yes. So I'm assuming you had some touch points also in that role still.
Oh, yeah.
I would love to understand, what role did AI play?
Yeah. And I even have some good insights on that. So Salesforce was doing AI before AI was AI, right? So, I mean, AI has been around for 70 years. So it's been, and every generation of AI is called AI, and it does something different, and it's a different aspect. So the new LLMs are what we're calling AI now, right?
Yeah, yes.
But I'll take a step back, that the prior generation of AI, Salesforce purchased a bunch of different companies doing things they called AI prior to the LLM revolution and pulled them together under a brand called Einstein. So Salesforce, yes. Einstein AI, and they paid or untold millions of dollars to the Einstein family to use that name, and then packaged up all these things that were basically a way to get more interesting insights out of the data. You've been collecting data in your CRM for years, and now you can do something with it. Instead of just getting them back in a chart, you can actually get some insights. Great for customers, terrible for SEs, because there's no data, right? And the whole way these things work is they're a black box.
Yeah.
You put in 10 million rows, uh-huh. and you get out an insight, right? That's for customers, that's wonderful. But for an SE trying to get out one insight for their demo, it was impossible. And the idea of having to reverse engineer the data set so that when you're doing your demo, you get the right answer.
And there's a degree of unpredictiveness.
Yeah, right. You're never even sure. So one of the things we did, and the work of Hanul Park, again, a really, really excellent developer, he worked with product management and he said, look, guys, this won't work for us. We can't have SEs just crossing their fingers when they do a demo and hoping the right thing comes out. So one of the things we did working with product management was had them build us a way around the black box so that SEs could inject the result into their demo mm-hmm. rather than having to put the data in. And there were things like, oh, well, you know, this product doesn't even work unless it has 10,000 rows. Okay, well, we need to turn that off, right? So there were behind the scenes switches you could switch that would allow an SE to use what we called marketing approved results. There was a list of things that could come out the other end that were real, not like anything they could think of. And they could choose from that list what they wanted the insight to be. And when they opened up the page and they clicked the button, it would yield that insight for them.
Yes.
And I think that's a really good example of when we're talking about demos touch everything, we spend a lot of time with product management, helping them learn how to sell their own product. Because they're building, a customer comes to them and says, oh, I have this use case and I'm a big financial services customer and we need this to be able to do this thing. And the product managers build the thing, but they don't think about how you're going to sell this product or this feature to the greater world. And so a demo team can be really useful because you've got SEs coming in to your demo assistance team, your demo support team saying, hey, we need you to build these things. That demo support team is coming into your demo architecture team saying, hey, you know, we're doing this over and over. It'd be really nice if we didn't have to do this 100 times a week. And then we're working with product management to say, hey, this thing is causing a lot of downstream effort. Can we add demo-only features into your product so that we can sell it?
All right. Okay, so the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
Product team was developing things in mind, so we are able to sell better, even though it's not necessary that would go large scale production.
Correct. I mean, it's even something silly like, can we change the create date on records that we pump into your product?
Right.
Because of course, a customer would never do that. That's a terrible idea, right? Yes. They're auditing. You'd want to audit everything.
Yeah.
But for demos, when my whole chart is the create date of cases, I need it to be the create date, or I need to be able to change the chart to some other date, some custom date, right? So we were working closely with product management to make products sellable. And I think, and this is one of those things that took us a few years to do this. This didn't all happen on day one, but we swam upstream through the product management process and helped product management understand how to sell their products and how their products were going to be sold if they didn't do these things, yeah. right? And I think that was a really important thing to do because it widened the value that this demo team had.
Yeah.
And educated a lot of product managers, and many of them got better at it. After a couple of rounds, they'd come to us and say, hey, I know this product works this way, but we've put this thing in this switch that you can turn off so that you can do this, you know, this demo only thing with
it. Yeah, this is fantastic. I think, I mean, at least based from my experience, very few product managers are thinking about it that way. That not only are you trying to deliver a function that provides value to your customers, but you're also considering how can I develop that feature so my colleagues are actually able to sell it.
Mm-hmm.
That is already quite a mature thought, I find, in the SaaS space, even for enterprise SaaS.
Yeah, I think there's probably a demo maturity model that I haven't had, but I haven't put together yet,
yes.
that has that. And that's at the top right corner.
Yeah,
right?
We need to come up with it.
Yeah, that's when you reach nirvana, product is giving you demoable products, right? But until then, you kind of have to twist their arm. And some of them get it. And some of them get it right away and understand it. Some of them are former SEs who've had to do this, and some never get it. And that's why your tooling team exists, because when it comes down to you, you go, okay, we're going to generate 10,000 lines and we're going to dump them in before you even get your demo environment, and you'll have everything you need.
I love that. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah. Really, really insightful. Cool stuff.
Yeah. So those were the four teams in one way or another that we were working with. And I think, you know, as you hear, we had impact on different parts of the business in different ways, but all of them centered around the SE. They may have reached another part, yes, but all of them were started from the assumption that an SE needed.
To be honest, I feel like this is a good point to maybe conclude. I was just one last question for you.
Sure, of course.
I mean, you've been doing this for a long time, and I mean, we've been talking for about 1.5 hours, so we are still actually scratching the surface of it. What is one thing that you still would like to share that is on your mind, which we haven't talked about today, but the world needs to know?
I would talk about administrative burden on SEs. Mm-hmm. It's very tempting. Actually, let me rewind. We haven't talked about analytics very much. Mm-hmm. I could talk all day about analytics, but I do have a couple of things. We can talk about how we measured some of the other things that we were doing as well.
What do you mean by analytics?
So for example, knowing how our demos were being used.
Okay.
Knowing how, being able to describe value to the demos themselves.
Yes.
So let me talk about that and lead into this final thing, because they're linked, and this is why I thought of it. So one way we measured the impact we had on the business is that every time a solution engineer spun up a new demo environment, mm-hmm, they had the option to tell us what deal they were using that demo environment for. And about a third of the time they told us.
Only a third?
Well, I'll take what I can get. And about a third of the time equaled $4.5 billion, right?
So, which is also says on your LinkedIn profile.
Right. So I was fine, right? Like, so I got my money.
But I mean, that's only one third of the actual number then.
Right? It was one third. And it was less than one third, because SEs would often reuse their demo environments. I certainly did. So I'd configure it a certain way, and then I'd show it to four or five, yes, different customers. So it's arguably a demo that came through my team was used for nearly every deal at Salesforce, but I can hardly take credit for all of the revenue. So I'll take credit for the piece that we could measure.
Yes.
And it was a couple of billion bucks. But we had long discussions about, could we measure that better? Could we ask SEs every time they're doing a demo, which demo environment are they using and what deal is it on? And the conclusion I reached was no. We could ask them to do that, but I didn't want to, because our whole remit was to reduce the burden on SEs.
Yes.
It was to make their lives easier. Mm-hmm. And if we were asking them to do something solely for the purpose of me beating my chest in front of management,
you put something on top.
We're adding things to them, and we're making their lives harder. So I think there's a temptation in business to measure everything and then to try to glean insights from that data that you've measured without thinking about the impact that's on SEs, mm-hmm, or anyone really for that matter. And so I would say to your listeners, think hard about the burden that you're putting on your SEs. Think hard about what you're asking of them. If you need it to justify your existence, I get it. But keep in mind that that's something for you and that's not for them. You know, in an ideal world, you can justify your existence as a team to management and they'll keep you going and you can keep helping SEs. If someone's asking questions and you need the data to back it up, you might have to put a burden on SEs to get the data. But if you can avoid it, do avoid it. And try to find ways that you can understand how people are using your products and derive value from those without interrupting their flow. For example, we implemented intra-demo measurement, which meant inside of each demo, we could see which screens SEs were going to most often.
Okay.
And it gave us a pretty good idea of one of two things. And I say this because I'm not sure which it was. Either we could see which products were being sold most in the field, or we could see which products were hardest to configure.
okay, because you can't differentiate between what is actually right now demoed versus what is being configured.
Correct, right? Okay, and if you went back to the screen 40 times, maybe you're running a rehearsal, or maybe, yeah, you just had to keep going back to fix something.
Or maybe the customer was asking many questions around it.
Or maybe there was a lot of interest, right? But it was interesting because we found, and this was very useful, we found that some screens were never seen.
Yes.
And so we could stop investing in those.
Right.
If nobody's showing this feature, first of all, we tell the product manager, no one's showing your product, right?
Oops.
But at least they know. And secondly, we don't throw any more resources into making that product easier, yeah, to demo. So it gave us our own prioritization, but it was a non-intrusive way of understanding how SEs were using our demo. We didn't ask them that. On the flip side of this, I talked briefly about surveys before. Mm-hmm. We did surveys every 6 months or so. And in the early days, we got more response than 6 months was probably too often. Probably yearly is better, just because SEs get tired of seeing the survey every 6 months. But we still got a statistically significant number of responses. And it's worth asking your SEs, what do you think? How do you like the tools? What would you make better? Mm-hmm. And I made a point, I know you mentioned automating, you know, going through all these survey results, but I made a point of reading all the comments.
Yes.
It was actually interesting. And I would do exactly that. I'd sit down one morning and I'd put all the comments in a spreadsheet and I'd read them one by one and I'd tally them and go, okay, well, these people are complaining about configuration time. These people are complaining about this. And these people said nice things, which was always good to hear too. But it was useful to ask SEs what they were facing mm-hmm. and not assume that we knew. But to ask them directly and not just assume that we could glean it from our measurements of what they were doing because of the uncertainty.
Yeah.
So all that brings me back to the administrative burden on SEs. Keep it as light as you can. Get what information you can from the tools you have and use that information as well as interaction with SEs to come up with ways to help them better. Mm-hmm. And the last piece of that is people who gave us a bad rating on our survey, I would contact and I would say, hey, I see you're not happy with our stuff. Tell me more. And most of the time they were slightly ashamed. They're like, no, I really like your stuff. I'm sorry for saying that. But most of the time they had really good points.
Yeah, and these are honest conversations.
Yeah, these were the best conversations because they weren't just going to say, oh, everything's wonderful.
Yeah.
No, I really struggle with this. I ran into this problem the other day and it made me angry. And then your survey came out, so I took it out of you. But these are the people you need to be talking to. Engage the critics because they can tell you. And a lot of their feedback is really useful. They can give you insights into what other people are experiencing but not saying.
Thanks for sharing that. Really insightful. It triggered a memory of mine. I recently read a report for the heck of me. I can't remember where it was. I know where to find it. Anyway, what it said basically was around the same line what you were elaborating on in regards to feature adoption. So you were talking about feature adoption from SEs in front of customers or what they were demoing and preparing to demo. This report I read was around feature adoption when it comes to the actual customer. And the same picture was actually painted. Basically, Pareto principle, 20% of the features are responsible for 80% of the adoption. And there are some features which are basically never used or just by 1% of your user base. That's also quite humbling, I think, if you work in product and also insightful if you work in solution engineering. Like, are you really hitting the right spots when you are demoing something? Or are you showing something that may be flashy, but really no one would ever use?
Right. And there's a couple of disconnects because there's what product wants to sell. It's what marketing wants to be selling, right? And we talked very briefly about AI and I changed the subject. We can go back to that. But like AI is a great example. Every company, top banner, center is we're an AI company, right? And our SEs, is that what they're leading with? Because once the door closes and you're in the room and you're with an SE and an AE and a customer, it's kind of up to them what's said. And so getting insights into what you're supposed to be, in quotes, selling, what you're actually selling. And then the third piece, what is actually selling? For what the SEs are telling customers, what are the customers actually buying?
Yeah, there's a whole nother conversation to be had here, maybe for another day. I'm thinking around what do you need to show in order to sell and what the customer in the end is really using might also not be the same thing.
Right. That's the fourth level of this, right? Is like what's actually, to your point, what are they actually implementing? What's sitting on the shelf and what's being used? And SEs are a critical part of that chain. But this is where we get into like, do we impose on them or do you make products so easy to sell that the SE wants to sell them?
I mean, if you're really opportunistic, you show the stuff that is so convincing that people think they need this, whether then they use other functionalities more often than that, fine by me, as long as I did my job.
Right.
Again, very simplistic and opportunistic point of view. But in the end, we are there. We are part of the go-to-market organization. We are there to bring revenue in. So I think it's definitely one way to look at it.
So AI, do you want me to talk about that?
We can take a little detour. I mean, this topic is...
It's huge.
it's quite big.
Good news. I don't have a lot of insights.
Please share the story that you have in mind.
Well, it's more some rumination. So I left Salesforce just at the front edge of the LLM revolution.
Right.
That was starting to happen. We were all starting to play with ChatGPT. They'd already implemented some ChatGPT agents by then for customer service, which seemed like the first obvious place to put them.
Yeah.
Like the AI story I told before, AI is really tough to demo. It's great. It's easy to demo and it's hard to demo. It's easy to demo because it's flashy and it's cool and people like it. Mm-hmm. It's hard to demo because, like you said, it's unpredictable. And you don't always know what you're going to get out of it when you ask the same question into it two or three
hallucinations.
Times. Hallucinations. Yeah. And as someone... I grew up doing theater, and that's kind of why I love demos. It's like having
a performance.
Yeah, it is. Hey, if I had known, if someone had told me when I was doing theater in like high school, like you can make money at this, really, and you don't have to be a famous actor to do it, I would have paid attention. I only found out later. But when you're doing a theater production, you're trying your best to control every part of that. So you're trying your best to have as much, exert as much control as you can over the final product. And it's very tricky with AI to do that because AI by definition is a little bit loose. It's sort of conversational and I don't want conversational. I want it to say the same thing that we said in rehearsal on opening night. So when companies are exploring their AI products and rushing them to market right now, as we all are, I think it's important to think again, how do you sell this? How do you make this compelling to the customer? And not just cross your fingers when you type something in that the SE is going to get the right answer on their screen. And in some cases, that may mean circumventing the AI altogether and equipping the SE with tools they can use to just predict the outcome very specifically by typing it in beforehand. It gets back to our discussion about live demo versus not live demo.
Yeah.
I think there are some cases where it may make sense to do a not live demo and in some cases where it should be live. And in AI, I'm leaning toward simulation in cases where there's a high risk, where there's a possibility of giving the wrong answer and causing the deal to fail.
I mean, the way I look at it, you have two alternatives. Number one, you simulate the outcome, so it's 100% under your control, or you have a data set that is so realistic that the AI is supposed to output what it's supposed to output. And if it doesn't, your product is broken and you can't blame the SE for it.
Yeah. But they'll still lose the deal. And the SE, right? And the SE, I joke, an SE can't win a deal, but they can lose one, right?
I see what you mean.
So, be nice to your SEs, by the way, because they can lose your deals for you. But yeah, I agree with you. I think functionally, that's exactly true. From an SE's world, you know, what I see is I want total control over what my
product
looks like.
No, I'm with you.
But what are you seeing? Because you've been around. I've been off vacationing for a year. What have you seen going on in the AI world and how it's impacting solution engineers?
Well, an ex-colleague of yours, Philipp Schöne, he is a manager at MuleSoft for an SE team. Mm-hmm. And he talked quite elaborate about the different programs and initiatives that are running within to support the SE team to become more effective and efficient both in their jobs, saving some of the grunt work that you described. Of course, AI can be a huge leverage for that. When I look at the work that I do, I don't know how representative that is because I'm not necessarily an SE anymore.
Right.
We are talking about SE enablement and sales enablement, but I'm using AI daily. I'm using it daily. I'm using it to improve my writing. I'm using it for a lot of creative assets, pictures, colors, visual language. Played a little bit around with video generation just for fun. And to be honest, I don't think it's at the level yet where I would need it in order to really be useful for me. Again, I'm not so sure how representative that is for what SEs are using. Yeah. If I look back, I would use AI now, of course. I mean, the types of services that you and your team are providing, not every company has the luxury of that type of team. So I think AI becomes even more useful there because there as an individual contributor, you can benefit of many of the things we talked about.
Yes.
Like for example, data set generation, consolidation of large information
pieces.
Look, we are in our program where we talk about discovery skills. We're also talking about how to write a good follow-up mail. You've come off from a 60-minute discovery call and a good follow-up email should contain what were the main pain points that you discussed, a summary of the discussion points, what were the negative consequences out of those pain points that you discovered, and so on. And now with AI joining basically all of our conference calls, we have a nearly perfect transcript. Now you can combine a transcript with a smart prompt, and it basically writes you the perfect follow-up email almost automatically.
Wow.
Very little adjustment needed. And that being said, almost no one is doing that. Mm-hmm. I see, as part of our job, we see follow-up emails on a daily basis because it's one of the tasks in our program. And I read these follow-up emails, and they are all not good. They are very technology-focused. They are very self-centered. Look at what we have. And they are very little concrete when it comes to what's actually the situation at the customer. But hopefully, well, if you had a meaningful conversation, the conversation should be full of those insights and you should mirror it back, maybe in different words, but mirror back what you have heard in a follow-up email. AI can be a fantastic tool for that. And once again, so very few people are using it for that, even though it's such an obvious use case.
Right. It's funny. SEs, for being as technologically forward as SEs can be, are often the last to adopt new technology to make their jobs easier. And I think when we talk about a demo organization or an SE support organization, part of their job is to go, hey, how could we use AI to make an SE's life easier? If an SE won't themselves, because they're busy or whatever, hey, could we do something where an SE types in a natural language query and gets back a data set that reflects what they're looking for,
right?
And saves themselves a couple of hours.
Yeah.
I agree with you. I'm weirdly, hugely into technology and also fearful and distrusting of it. And I think having an intervening organization that goes, hey, we did something cool. You don't need to worry about how it works. Just you press this button and it works can be really useful.
I'm super excited to, I mean, this becomes a bit philosophical now, but I'm super excited to live in this day and age where the speed of development of innovation that is happening is so fast. I still remember I was like a 10-year-old. I got like a Game Boy for Christmas gift. And this was like the high technology at the time. And now what we have is insane. So I'm super keen to be part of it and super keen to see what we are still going to see, which going to also affect not only our private lives, but of course our business lives and our jobs. So yeah, I'm all here for it. Micah, this has been probably one of the longest conversations we've had on this podcast, but I really enjoyed it. I certainly learned a lot about what it means to scale an enterprise SE team, where we literally talk about like thousands of SEs and what is a meaningful way to support this role in to do an even better job. I think you've given us some fantastic, very concrete examples of what such a team can contribute. Not only I can say is I'm very grateful that you joined me on my invite to on this podcast, and thanks for sharing that.
Thank you. The pleasure was all mine. I could talk about this all day, but I'm really glad we got to talk about it for an hour.
Das war Presales Unleashed, dein Podcast für Sales Engineering im B2B-Softwarevertrieb. Falls du tiefer ins Thema Discovery eintauchen möchtest, haben wir jetzt eine Überraschung für dich. Wir haben einen kostenlosen E-Mail-Kurs nur für dich erstellt. Und normalerweise ist dieser exklusive Coaching-Content nur für unsere zahlenden Kunden zugänglich. Aber so erhältst du jede Woche kostenlos wertvolle Insights, ein kleines Nugget direkt in dein Postfach. Klingt spannend? Dann schau mal in die Shownotes und melde dich an. Schön, dass du wieder mit dabei warst. Bis zum nächsten Mal.